size. The next slide there's talking about the attributes of the child counselor relationship. I think for all of you sort of au fait with counseling and so on, I think it's fairly obvious, and I think that it's pretty much the same qualities that you would have working with an adult client. I would sort of throw in there with children an ability, obviously it's preferable of course to like children, that would be the first thing I would say, and I say that in jest, but you can be working with a child as you can with an adult client and not really like them that much. It is obviously possible, and that's where your supervision comes in. So yeah, presumably if you're in this type of work, you would enjoy working with children, but you'll get personality types that just don't gel with you, and to be aware of that and what that raises for you. I think it's good to be able to be playful. So if you get readily shy or embarrassed and, you know, don't want to put on silly voices or act or play, or if you just don't like games and things like that, to be aware of that sort of thing that is relevant. I'm not a games person myself. I don't like games. And sometimes when I was working with children, I confess to being quite bored sometimes and watching the clock, and I really had to use supervision to process then what was going on for me. So you recognize within yourself your strengths and your weaknesses. Stupid, superficial things for me, which is, you know, I should not confess things like this, but it really cramped my style working with little ones, because I like heels, as you can see. And you can't wear stilettos that are going to impale a child's little hand, for instance. So I had to really rethink everything. You get paint on you and sand and water. So yeah, that just went against everything about who and what I am. So that's just a silly aside. But yeah, to think about what qualities you would bring to working with a child and being playful and comfortable with a child. Are there any that you can see all the attributes that are there? This is just one view of what is necessary. So a connective link with the child's world and the counsellor is obviously to be exclusive and safe, authentic, purposeful, non-intrusive, and of course confidential, and we'll come to that in a minute. Do you think there's anything else there that you would like to add, what you think might be important in working with children that we haven't highlighted yet? Anything? No? Okay. All right, now there's this little story to illustrate the point that I'm going to go into now about how you would work with that child in the therapy room. So there's once a kindly elephant who accidentally stood upon a hen. She was much distressed, especially when she looked down and saw all the little chickens running around cheeping. Poor little creatures, I will be a mother to them. And gathering the chickens tenderly underneath her, she sat down upon them. So okay, now the reason I've included that is I think when you're working with children who are so vulnerable, and even with adults we have that instinct often, we want to protect them, we want to fix them, we want to make their world better, and we really want to look after them. And with children it's that much more intensified inevitably. If you're a mother, probably your mothering instincts might come out. If you're a teacher and familiar with children, you might want to guide them. The problem is that sometimes that can become, in a way, obstructive, a barrier to the child's own process. So for instance, you may very kindly motivated, so that child I was talking about who did not know how to play, and my instinct would be, oh, shall we play in the sand, or shall we do this, shall we do that? And in supervision, I was taught no, because you need to show a total acceptance of that child where they at. They come to counselling from a chaotic world, and you are there to contain that world for them. And they're coming from worlds where who and what they are may not be acceptable and okay. So they need to feel that from you. They need to feel that safety. So if the child is bored, so you're bored. It's okay to be bored. You're sad. It's okay to be sad. Oh, I can see you very angry right now. So it's okay to be angry. It may not be okay how you show or exhibit that anger, because it can be destructive, but you're allowed to be angry, so the feeling is okay, but not what you do with it. So in trying to help and to fix, sometimes we inhibit. With a child telling their story, sometimes there's the temptation to almost help them with their story. But if you do that, if you direct it, then it's becoming about your story. And it's not theirs. They need to go where they need it to go. So you fit in with their play. So for instance, a child might say, okay, I want you to be the witch. Don't make assumptions. Say something like, because I would immediately think, oh, witch is bad, from my experience. But you don't, because you don't know what their witch is. So to say, oh, you want me to be a witch. Okay, do you want me to be a bad witch, or do you want me to be a good witch? So in other words, you're asking them how you want to be, what role you want them to assign to you. So it always is about them. Then, not to interpret what they're doing. So for example, a child might be burying a figure in the sand, and instead of trying to put words into the child's mouth like, oh, it must be scary to be buried under there, under all that sand, well, maybe that's not their experience, because maybe that's where they're feeling safe. It means they're hiding away from something. So rather more observing what they're doing. So in that instance, you would say something along the lines of, oh, I noticed that person, you're burying them under the sand. I wonder what that's like for that person under the sand. And so it gives them an opportunity to tell you if they can, and they may not be able to. So you're playing alongside, you're observing, you're encouraging, you're reflecting back the whole time. So whatever they're doing, oh, I notice you seem very proud of that dinner you've just cooked on the stove. That was the thing about praise. I want to come back to that point where I said, your picture, wow, it looked good. That in child or in play therapy is something you would be encouraged to avoid, actually praising. Now it's instinctive then to just, wow, what a lovely picture you've drawn, wow, let's look at that. Well, there are a couple of dangers with that, and it's not to say you rubbish the picture or anything like that. But first of all, they need to be allowed to not be good at something. So if they're struggling with something, or they're trying to do something and they can't quite get it, that it's okay, rather than, oh, let me help you do that. No, they must be accepted for not being able to do something, because maybe in the outside world, they're not accepted for not being good at something. Then if you're praising, the one danger is, they may then keep doing more of the same to get your approval as the therapist. Oh, she was pleased with me when I did that. So, oh, I'm going to try and do more of that. But that may not be the helpful direction for them to go. So it's a bit like with our adult clients. You are facilitating the client's self-empowerment. So you're not even empowering the client. You're helping the client empower themselves so that they're not dependent on you. Because you're not going to be in their lives forever, so they obviously end up quite attached to you and so on, but that's where your boundaries and so on will come in. But yes, if you're praising, they get too attached to you, that's not really helpful for them in the long run. So something like that is quite important in working with children. And I know your instinct is there to want to. But it's not helpful. Does anyone have any views on that or any thoughts around that?
I think that'd be I think you're right, that'd be really hard for me, because I think a natural thing for me with a child, I know my young nieces and nephews, it is to praise them and say, oh, that's really good, and be excited with them, and and I hadn't actually thought of it from that perspective really, so that's really useful to think about that.
Yeah.
It'd be difficult for me to do, which is why I'm never going to work with children. Mm-hmm. I don't like that.
See, I think you might. I understand that, because in school, we work very much, and I know a few people I know in here, we work a lot with positive praise. Mm-hmm. So we tend to ignore the not so good and praise the praise the good.
Yeah.
And then, because we certainly from a behaviour point of view, we say, you know, we praise specifically, because the more you praise, the more you get, the more the child wants to please you. So in a classroom environment, actually, you want to encourage
it's motivating academically.
So when we see that handwriting and we praise that handwriting, what we want to see more of that, that's wonderful, you know, because actually you want them to think, oh, actually, I can do it, I'll do it on another page, I'll do it on another page. That's quite... To separate those two worlds is quite hard.
It's difficult, isn't it? And it does go against all instinct. You want to build up the kid and make them feel good about themselves, and but it can have, you know, so rather reflecting back. So if a child's done something, wow, look at this, isn't this great? Rather than saying, yeah, I do think that's fantastic, it would be, I can see you are really pleased with what you've just done. So you're turning it back onto them, so they're validating themselves noticing.
It's like the locus of evaluation within them and helping them to internalise it.
Yeah.
And I guess with your behavioural approach, you could do that too. Sorry, I don't know your name.
Helen.
Sorry, with your behavioural approach, I guess you could do that too. Like you praise them and then you help them to internalise that evaluation of their own work as well.
That's really it's huge actually.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't do that. But now I think I might, that's certainly something that I would do, because I think, what does it mean? I think I'm quite careful to use specific praise, so not a general, oh, you're really good at that, or, oh, that's great, or you are good. It's more, I love the way that you've written that.
Yeah.
That's a fantastic point.
You have to be, so it is specific, but then, but I don't take it any further than how do you feel, you know, what's your feelings on that, or,
Yeah. It's allowing time as well. I've worked with physically disabled children.
Yeah, yeah.
We teach them independence, because obviously they're with us for 14 years. So there is a time when they're going to leave and they're going to go out into that big world. That big world is not so caring.
Mm.
So it's allowing them the time to accomplish something like undoing a coat or taking a coat off. And not rushing in, because you're tempted to rush in because you've got a busy day and the teacher's anxious to get working and you want to get the kids' coat off and hung up and you want to get the bags, but allowing them the time to do it themselves, because when they actually do it themselves, they'll turn around and say, oh miss, I've undone all my buttons, or I've just undone one button, I can do a zip, you know, and the sense of achievement is incredible. Mm. And you don't need to praise them, because they've achieved it themselves. And one more thing they can do as they go out into the world.
Wow. Thank you, that's a perfect example to illustrate the point. Wow, you must get really deeply attached to these children.
Tell me about it. I retired recently and I still go in one day a week. I can't leave them alone.
Oh.
I love them, you know, so much. And they love me, so
yeah, I bet they
it's
do.
A two-way thing. And I found that out when I retired, you know, the cards and the things that people sent were amazing.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, amazing stuff. All right, so some points to consider. You would contract with a child just as you would with an adult, with obvious variations. So you wouldn't necessarily have a paper contract the way you would with an adult client. So it might be a contract through with the parent, for example, or it might be through the school. But you definitely still verbally contract with a child to keep them safe, boundaried, and contained. And obviously within that, confidentiality is everything, and explain, I'm not going to go and tell mummy what you're sharing with me, I'm not going to tell your friends, I'm not going to go and tell your teacher, but explaining obviously child protection issues and when you will have to break confidentiality. Yeah. I know sometimes working, let's say with adolescents, when they, you know, it's hard maybe for them to actually talk and say something, and it might restrict them. They may think, oh, if I tell you about this, then you're going to go and inform somebody. And so the temptation might be, well, let's not say about the confidentiality breaking then. Then it becomes a massive problem, because what if they do then disclose something that you have to go and tell? And you would just lose the absolute trust of that child, because you didn't say that you would have to tell anyone. You said everything was between us. So it's really important that the kids know where they stand, and then they choose what they will or they won't reveal. Also, as I've said before, they might be coming from very chaotic worlds, and so you're creating that space where they know what they can and can't do. There's unconditional positive regard, but of course there's that mutual respect. So in this room we don't break the toys, or we will put everything away when we've finished, and we don't hurt each other, because they need to know that, and it keeps them safe, and it allows you to sort of keep it in an ordered fashion. So it's that containment, I think, would be the key word. So everything about those boundaries is important. The timekeeping, that can be really hard sometimes with winding up a session, because for instance, if you're working in a school, I don't want to go back to the classroom and do history or maths or something. I'm having loads of fun playing here. Well, that's something you need to work with. Acknowledge, oh, I can see this is feeling really hard for you to draw this to a close, but we need to. And then you give the time warnings. All right, oh gosh, look, we've only got 10 minutes left. I think we need to start putting things away. I notice you're not wanting to stop playing now. and your instinct would be, little, do it. You know, if it's, again, if it's your own child, it's like, would you bloody well knock it off and kill it? But you can't, obviously. So you do it in a way that is healthy. But yes, they need that structure.
Have a good
because
question,
they feel
sorry,
safe. Yes.
About the working within the boundary and
yes,
certainly with regards to behaviour.
Yes.
And possible aggression.
Yes.
And wondering how you balance the unconditional positive regard, the acceptance of the child as they are with you in that moment.
Yes.
With issues like breaking toys and aggression.
Yes.
Because for some children,
yeah,
that may be where they are at that point in time.
Absolutely.
And you know, they're there for a reason within the room, and what's brought them to that stage, why
yeah,
they're showing you that behaviour, and
yeah,
that I'm not clear how you marry those two together.
Yeah, so I think it's, and I'd love to hear all of your views, and I'm sure some of you have some great ideas on this. I think for me it would just come back to that whole principle of you're okay, what you're feeling is okay, but how you're expressing it is not feeling safe for me or for you. So the action, we can't be doing that, because these toys, for instance, are to be used by other children in other sessions, so they belong to, you know, so we need to look after the things. So it's okay to say that sort of thing and to contain in that way, but just making sure you always relay, like you would with an adult client, you know, who's maybe, you know, been violent or stolen something. Or so you're okay as the individual, but what you, the way you're expressing that is not feeling okay.
I'm
if
just
that
wondering,
makes sense.
It's just really about how the child may or may not be able to understand that, given it depends, I guess, on how old the child might be and
yeah,
how, because a lot of it depends, I guess, on how well advanced their verbal skills are and their cognitive skills, and how they might process that, or whether they can get to an understanding of that distinction. Because
yeah, I think
adults obviously
yeah,
are that much further along in their cognitive development, but.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you ever experience it where, you know, children maybe can't make that distinction yet.
I think, you know, in make no mistake, there are lots of situations where it can be quite hard to contain, and I think in support of that, I've put some recommended reading. There's a book called Dibs.
Yeah,
I've put it on here. I would recommend you read that, and you can see what happens, you know, that whole process and a child in their world. But you will get kids sometimes who are so angry or so upset that they might throw things and break things, and you may have moments of feeling quite overwhelmed and panicky, and what do I do in this instance? And that's when I, you know, that's your supervision comes in. What do I do? How do I manage this? And yeah, it can happen. And do any of you have ideas on how would you manage a situation, for instance, like that?
I think I was just thinking, actually, as you were saying that, Jo, I guess if a child was coming into a room where the toys obviously weren't theirs, they were owned by the organisation or whatever, then I guess, I suppose it feels, to me, it would feel okay to say, because these are not our toys, that's not sort of acceptable sort of behaviour. I don't sort of mean in that quite directly, but I mean to put that message across. If they brought their own toy in and they were breaking their own toy, I think I'd do something differently. Because it's their toy, I'd explore why, you know, maybe what was going on for them and what was going on while they were breaking that toy. But if the toy didn't belong to them, I'm guessing, in society, people have to know that damaging things that are not theirs is not acceptable by society, is it? So
yeah,
I guess if they're not, they've got to have that learning needs to come from somewhere. It doesn't come from home. I don't know, it's difficult.
Yeah, it is. The reason I think I've come to that question is because I work with children, a lot older children, with challenging behaviours. And it's not something, I think some of it is about the setting. Where is the expectation of where they learn those boundaries?
Is it
appropriate for them to be learning that within the therapeutic setting? I guess that's what I'm asking, because they're two very different.
I would say that if the equipment that you're using belongs and is shared, because other children are going to be playing with that in the therapy context. And although that you might think that that's a different environment and the rest of the school time is a different environment, the consequence and action is still the same. So you can't be all softly, nicely in play therapy because that's what you think. Because that, in its sense, is a negative, because you're allowing a breakage to be accepted when it isn't. You know, you wouldn't break it in the classroom. If you did break it in the classroom, it'd be reprimanded. If you break it in play therapy, again, although it's a therapy, the situation is that this child is playing with something. Now, if he's broken it intentionally through anger and rage, then that's part of the therapy. That's part of his process or her process.
But it's still not accepted. But it's not acceptable to display it that way, is it? Because that's like taking it a little bit further. And when they grow up, that's I'm guessing where sort of domestic violence comes from. Because if you don't learn to appropriately to display that anger, then it's going to sort of build into something else, isn't it?
But you still have to tell them that there's a consequence for it.
Yeah.
Because that's like what you said, in society, if you do something wrong, there's a consequence and action for it.
I think it comes down to, is it my understanding of what play therapy is actually about? You asked that question at the beginning. What are you trying to achieve with the child?
Yeah.
Are you trying to help put in place these appropriate boundaries, which are very important?
Yeah.
Or are you there to listen to the child's process and for them to be heard?
Yeah.
And I think there's a difference between the two, and I'm not quite clear in my
mind,
whether there's an overlap, and it depends.
I think they overlap a bit, because in listening to the child and what's going on for them, the boundaries are a way of containing what it is they're trying to tell you, to help them to feel safe enough to allow what needs to unfold happen. So I haven't been in any situations where I really felt, oh my goodness, you know, breaking of toys and things like that. I once was, a child was putting water in the sand tray and very deliberately just went, dish, splashed the water to get me totally wet. I was really not happy, but I couldn't shout at it as I would probably my own poor child. So what I did was I then just said, oh, I noticed you splashed me, and I'm feeling quite sad about that because look, I'm all wet now. So, oh, I'm not really very comfortable with that. So I watched my tone. So I didn't shout, I didn't raise my voice, but I made it clear.
I wanted to. Saint, aren't you?
One does need patience. That's